Counsel?
Let me ask you this. She has a very sympathetic case, both on the facts and kind of as a moral issue. The difficulty is our circuit precedent. So what do we look to that would allow equitable tolling or letting us ignore what has been strictly enforced? Because the only precedent we have relates where there's some affirmative misleading by government officials. So I'm interested to know what you rely on and what we should look to.
Well, yeah, I rely on first Young v. U.S. The Supreme Court applied equitable tolling, and this was decided after Stowe. And I also rely on David v. West and most recently Stonko, who applied to the Federal Circuit, which interpreted the Supreme Court language at the end of Stowe v. INS to mean that statutes of limitation and time and are subject to equitable tolling unless Congress expressed a contrary intent. This court agreed with that interpretation and so called Gonzalez by stating that the language of the end of, at the end of Stone was not intended to overrule the general rule in Irwin that statute of limitation was presumptively subject to equitable tolling. The court further stated that Congress is presumed to be aware of the doctrine of equitable tolling, and unless they express clear intent, it will not apply. Congress has expressed no such intent with the length of 12.2. The fact is that the Supreme Court is considered to be subject to the number of the railroad to determine whether equitable tolling should apply, or whether the language is particularly strong and the timing limit is particularly generous. The language of 12.2 is not particularly strong or bad, and the 30-day time limit is not particularly generous.
Would you point me to the language in 12.52 from which we would divine that it's not particularly strong or clear?
Well, the language of 1252, the language that the Supreme Court has considered, Your Honor, has been, and how to actually apply equitable tolling is much, much stronger. Cases of Alvarez and Shane, the Federal Circuit's decision in, most recently in Thompson v. Chow, stated that the time to file is barred and that, there will be no further appeal. The word must in 1252 is not nearly as bad as when equitable tolling has been applied.
So the word deadline and must be filed, in your view, would leave some kind of small, but nonetheless existing, I wouldn't call it a loophole, but some area, gray area, you think, in the mind of a filer.
Yes, Your Honor, I would say that. she exercised the government, and I'm familiar with the attempt to file her appeal and rely on the government's conduct in cashing the check and accepting the government's ruling she had. But even if this court does determine that it's going to be mandatory jurisdictional, cases such as Hernandez, Rivera, Singh, and Camacho indicate that this court can still entertain jurisdiction in rare circumstances. This is such a rare case.
You're about a little more than halfway into the 10 minutes allotted to your side of the case. Did you wish to pass the baton to your co-counsel?
I will hold it out there.
Okay.
Just a brief thing. Michelle Martin, who effectuate her right to federal review, confirmed that any she received in the USCIS website email information about federal review. She still intends to appeal the right to appeal.
Can you speak up a little bit? Thank you. Okay, thank you for your argument. Your side has about 2 minutes for a rebuttal. Thank you. We'll hear from the government at this time.
Good morning, Your Honor. Please record the urgent memo here on behalf of the respondent.
Good morning.
Your Honor, Justice McKeown, you accurately point out that in order for this court to reach the issue of equitable tone, that you have to get past its own precedent and grant Brown's sin. Also, the court would have to get past the plain language of the court, the Supreme Court used in Stone, where they said that petitions for review, the primary of this time review, are mandatory and jurisdictional, and are, in quote, are not subject to equitable tolling. Of course, the other side is arguing that that language doesn't mean what the Supreme Court says it does, or the Supreme Court has never distanced itself from that.
What, though, do you make of Hernandez-Rivera, when he said that the rule is not absolutely inflexible and that the appellate tribunal may, in unique circumstances, extend the filing deadline.
The court did say this court and other courts only recognize basically two exceptions, and that's where it is, the official misleading, and then where in the other circumstances where the board doesn't give them proper notice, which is not an issue at all in this case. And so the only exception this case might fit under the existing law of this circuit is the fact that it was official misleading. In this case, there certainly wasn't any official misleading by the board. The board certainly isn't in the not required to notify. There are due process arguments that the board should have notified them of their right to judicial review. The board has never done that. No court in the country has ever held that the board is required to provide them.
Wouldn't you think, whether they're required to or not, we wouldn't have so many of these cases if they just did a real simple thing, which was put at the bottom of all their opinions, you have a right to appeal the next day's, cite the regulation, and...
However, the petitioner also held to the presumption that they know the law.
I understand that. I'm just...
Right.
You hear my suggestion.
Right.
You represent the service,
right,
or now the department.
I'll take that.
It sure would be easy.
Well, so, you know, you have to answer all these claims, and whether they're misfiled, missent, lack of notice. We get a lot of these cases, and we spend a lot of time like we are this morning. So... It could be simply cured. You know, it's a one line.
It's a suggestion.
Let me ask you this about the AAU. They cashed the check, right?
Right.
And then what happened? Do they still have the money?
I'm not sure.
They still have the money?
I don't know.
Are they acting on the petition?
Sorry?
Are they acting on the petition? Is the AAU acting on this petition?
No.
How do you know?
Because they rejected it.
Yeah.
I would want to address that point.
Yeah.
You know, if they had filed their petition in the wrong circuit, without question, that circuit would have transferred the case to us. If they had filed it in district court, without question, the district court would find the proper place for it and send it there. If they filed it in state court, you have to believe that somebody would say, wait a minute, you're in the wrong place. They file it with the Immigration Service, who cashes the check, keeps the money. What did they think this was, a contribution for the betterment of society or something like that?
No, I agree with you. In terms of the district court and another circuit court filing in another court of appeals, clearly then they're going to be properly filed in a 903 court and transferred to San Jose. I don't believe that the case law would allow for transfer by state or actually federal court. I'm not aware of any of those courts. You have to look at this case. She filed this notice with the INS, totally and absolutely the wrong agency. She could have done any number of things.
You know, I'd be willing to bet that if you went to the first-year constitutional law class at Harvard Law School and excluded anyone who had actual personal experience with immigration law and said, okay, you've got a client who lost an asylum appeal before an immigration judge and then was denied review by the Board of Immigration Appeals, where do you file the appeal? And you gave them the choice of the Court of Appeals or the agency, I would guess half of the people in that class, some of the most outstanding undergraduate students and now law students in the country, would say, oh, with the agency.
With all due respect, Your Honor, it doesn't explain why hundreds, if not thousands of pro se aliens every year manage to properly file their petitions for review with the circuit court.
I think it's a miracle. Let me ask you.
I think that's another thing.
I think
that
so.
I'm just telling you that they do.
I know, we see them. We have...
Yes.
50% of our docket, so we're pretty aware. Let me ask you about the form. You have this Justice Department form. It says Immigration and Naturalization Service. And then at the top of it, and it's actually in record number, I believe, 08 of the excerpt. It says Notice of Appeal to the Administrative Appeals Unit. What would you use that form for?
Right. I'll tell you that. What the petitioner did was she went to the INS website looked at how you appeal a substantive decision filed, issued by the INS. as I said earlier, this decision wasn't issued at all by the INS. In fact, it was issued by the Board of Immigration Appeals, and she could have done any number of things to find out how to appeal that. What she did was very unreasonable in fact that she went to the INS website, and that is the form that she used. If the INS denies an application or a petition, that's the form that she used. It has no bearing whatsoever to anything related to the INS.
So this is usually, it's a kind of a pre-administrative appeal for actions of the INS?
Right. At the district level, the INS makes a decision, and they can have one chance to refer to administrative review as to the administrative appeal to the INS when they file that form. There's nothing whatsoever to do with the Board of Immigration. I would say that she could have done any number of things in terms of her due diligence to have reasonably found out how to file those. She was represented by counsel and she was in front of the board. She could have, even though she couldn't afford to hire the counsel to take this appeal, she could have called and said, okay, I've gotten a decision from the board, just tell me where and how do I file it. That was one thing she could have done. She could have decided, I'm going to have a consultation with an immigration attorney, pay for an hour consultation, and find out how to properly file this appeal. There's, as you know now, there's hundreds of these Indonesian asylum cases floating around in the system. They could have consulted the people in the Indonesian community as to how to protect this because the mosque, other places where they have contact with the Indonesian community, they could have asked them. Many of these cases are working through ways for these problems in Indonesian asylum cases. The thing that could have been, she could have actually come back right here back to Seattle, where she had her immigration hearing here in Seattle. She could have gone to the immigration court here in Seattle and said, you know, I've gotten this final decision from the board. Can you please tell me what I have to do? Instead, she set off on this course, which was not very well reasoned or well thought out. She just randomly goes to the INS website and then logs on to this appeal process for INS decisions, and she runs with that. Without making any other inquiries. The record is completely deployed in terms of her due diligence and prevent anything else other than visiting the INS website.
Could you also just remind me, at the end of the BIA one-line opinion, it says to see this CFR 1003. What does that say?
That's the streamline regulation.
All right. It says it's a final that it's permissible to streamline.
Right. That's the final decision. So in terms of due diligence, the court can I don't believe the court can find equitable tolling in this case.
So if you went on the INS website, and I haven't gone there for a long time, where are the instructions? Are there instructions on the INS website on how to take an appeal? Properly?
No. How to appeal from the BIA. Is that on the site?
I don't believe so, because
so,
it wouldn't be the INS's people.
Is there something on the BIA website?
I thought there was petitions that represented the different reasons. But the court can avoid the very difficult. The court would have to go out, essentially creating a new exception outside of the existing case law of this circuit to find equitable tolling applies in this case. And I think that this court could avoid that hard question by simply finding that in terms of the actual merits of the case, I think it would be very difficult for the court to get to the merits because you have to find equitable tolling that applies to the kind of case, and you'd also have to find that she exercised due diligence. But as to the merits of the asylum case, if the court were to reach that, I would rest on my letter brief that I wrote regarding the merits of the asylum case. Distinguishing the case from Sale, which incidentally I believe the government is secretly
okay, thank you for your argument. We'll have a rebuttal argument at this time.
Thank you. To answer your question, no, they have not refunded Michelle Omar's money.
Did she ask for it back? Is that in the record?
Your Honor, as soon as she realized that her appeal wasn't probably pending, this court has taken judicial notice of documents in the government's control that well before they informed Ms. Shalimar she was to be deported, they had district directors in the office, not just a clerk at the AAU, were aware she'd appealed in the wrong place, were ordered to tell her she'd appealed in the wrong place and refund her money, and that still has not been done. Recently in Lanza v. Ashcroft, this court stated that an alien's right to judicial review is not something to be taken lightly, and that personal freedom can only be preserved when there are checks on arbitrary governmental action, and reaffirming the principle that an alien facing deportation has a Fifth Amendment right to a fundamentally fair process. Ms. Shalimar not only faces deportation, she faces deportation to a country in which she and her family may face persecution due to their Chinese ethnicity and Christian religion. She and her family face deportation to a country in which Chinese Christians are persecuted regularly and the government is unwilling to control the persecution. The immigration judge in this case failed to consider the record as a whole and improperly applied the law. The Board of Immigration Appeals failed to follow their own regulations and issued an affirmance without opinion in this case.
Let me ask one question. You are actually a little bit over your time. Is there any evidence in the record to suggest that any of the acts directed against Ms. Shalimar were based on the knowledge of the people inflicting the harm or the threat that she had converted to the LDS faith?
It is assumed, Your Honor, in and there is evidence in the record on documents of people situated in Indonesia that most of the Chinese in Indonesia are Christians. And those that aren't persecuted are the ones who have obviously converted to Muslim.
Yep. My question is, any evidence in the record on the merits portion of the petition that suggests that any of these actions directed against her were based on the fact that she had converted to the Mormon faith?
It can be inferred from the people similarly situated as her that the vast majority of sexual assaults and things that they faced happen when people are Mormon or Christian or Chinese.
Thank you for your argument. Thank both sides for their argument. The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and we'll proceed to Citizens for Mobility against Secretary Mineta.